The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. Before beginning our program, we would like to invite you to sign up for a free trial subscription to one of our publications at irei.com. Whether you are interested in real estate, infrastructure, or real assets in general, IREI has a publication to suit your needs. Select Publications on the main menu to choose a publication. Interested in more than one? Sign up for them all.
Welcome to the program. Our guest is Tom Polson. He's Director of Global Investments for Pentaveret. He's also a recognized expert on Islamic finance, and that's why he joins us today. Tom directs Pentaveret's subsidy, Hemaya Financial Group. The company provides Sharia-compliant investment management services for emerging market investors through the issuance of Islamic bonds and private placements that target the acquisition of high-yield physical assets in North America and Europe. Tom holds a postgraduate degree and a postgraduate diploma and a master's degree in Islamic finance. Again, he's an expert in this area. Recently wrote a piece on it for Institutional Real Estate Americas in the September edition. But we wanted to talk to Tom so we could expand on this just a bit. So without further ado, Tom Polson, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike. I'm glad to be here. Also glad to do some follow-up on the article. There's been a lot of good information that came out after it was written, which would have made it an even better article, but I guess that's why we're here today.
Islamic finance, there's probably a lot of people who are right off the bat, just it's a mysterious area, which is, I think, one of the reasons there's not so many experts in it like you, and so many people, it's just a question mark to so many people. Why don't we start there? Give a brief history or overview of the Islamic finance industry.
Yeah. The principles in deployment have been around for almost 1,600 years, but its modern form is really quite recent. There were some community banking initiatives in Egypt in the 70s, the Islamic Development Bank, which is a major global aid organization that was set up in 75, Dubai Islamic Bank started around then, another big one called Al-Raji, and then the interesting one, in 81, there was a company called the DMI Trust, which was set up in Geneva, Switzerland, and it's one of the largest Islamic banking conglomerates in the world. They own institutions across multiple countries and have assets in the tens of billions of dollars. But Islamic banking in this modern context was still largely a very academic exercise up until the mid-80s. And so a lot of the foundations which the modern system is built upon in terms of how contracts are constructed, how we generate profits, how the transfer of ownership, all these kind of things came about through these economists. And the two big ones, the guy named Mohamed Umar Shapra and another one, Dr. Mohamed Najatollah Siddiqui. But this was a very academic exercise. These were almost like events that took place in cities around the world where all these people that had been working on this discipline their entire lives would get together and they would talk about it just like people in other academic fields have these salons, as sometimes they're called. But then by the 1990s, the industry really took off, and it was in Asia, it was in Arabia, there was even some things happening here in the U.S., Africa, and so on. But today, it's a massive global industry. There's things about it that most people would probably never guess.
Give us a few. What are some of the surprises that...
Surprise, early on in my career, and I'm not terribly old, I'm still under 40, but when I started in the industry after grad school around 2010, I had the good fortune to meet two people, and their job title was Global Head of Islamic Finance. And where do you think they worked? One guy was at UBS, another guy was at Deutsche Bank, and JP Morgan even has a guy with the same exact job title. So these global major financial institutions have dedicated departments. Goldman Sachs has an Islamic finance department. And then even some of the largest global law firms in the world have Islamic finance departments, because so much of the global capital movement in Islamic finance moved just like traditional investments, right? You have offshore trusts in the Caymans for private equity, for real estate, for other vehicles, and you've got lawyers in London and Luxembourg, and tax people at KPMG handling the auditing assistance. So at the end of the day, finance is finance. You just put it in a wrapper to meet the religious principles of a massive amount of capital that moves around the globe. It's really quite fascinating.
So some of these Middle Eastern countries like Abu Dhabi and I think Saudi Arabia and others have enormous sovereign wealth funds. Do those sovereign wealth funds, are they Sharia compliant or do they follow Islamic finance principles? Because when you talk about the size or the amount of money, I tend to think that they must be part of that capital flow.
We would hope so. They definitely all have dedicated units that do it, but the sheer size of those institutions, the Abu Dhabi Fund, ADIA, has $600-800 billion. And if you were to look at the actual number of institutional grade investment products out in the world, in the Islamic finance space, they would eat up every single one. So it's not really capable. And also you have to think about a sovereign wealth fund's diversification needs. They need to be in every country on the globe. They need to be in a combination of high risk, low risk, yield, real estate, private equity, venture capital. There's just not enough vehicles out there to meet that demand. And then also if you were to look at the central banks in the region, you would think they would also play a role, but, you know, a central bank operates just like a central bank anywhere else in the world where they have to have cash deposits. So like the Saudi central bank, SAMA, they have, I think at their height, they had somewhere around $400 billion in U.S. Treasury because, you know, they have to generate that yield for the bank to run the whole, to run the country. So it's a great thing that the industry is working towards. There just isn't enough volume to take that money in.
So which countries are leaders in the Islamic finance industry? Is this another surprise where it's non-Islamic countries or is it primarily Islamic countries?
Yeah. Another surprise is here in the United States, we have a mutual fund company called Saturna Capital. It's in Bellingham, Washington, about 20 minutes south of the Canadian border. And they have had an Islamic mutual fund business since the 90s. They have four funds which cover income, growth, and even a fixed income component. And total assets under management are, I believe, around $3 billion. So it's one of the largest Islamic mutual funds programs in the world. But the other side, if you look at the size of the market, if you look at it from a retail perspective or a man-on-the-street perspective, Saudi Arabia and Malaysia are the leaders because in those two countries, you can have your Sharia-compliant bank account, insurance, your car, your home, your pension plan, every financial aspect of your life can be Sharia-compliant. And in those two countries, they're really the leaders. You know, you might think other countries around the Gulf play that role as well, but a lot of those countries have conventional and Islamic financial institutions, and a lot of those countries, say the United Emirates, has somewhere around 80% of the residents are foreigners. So you don't have a constituency which is Sharia only.
Interesting. So you're known to be bullish on. I won't even venture to the word that you use for Islamic bonds is called what?
Sukuk.
Sukuk. Okay, S-U-K-U-K for our listeners. So, and you're bullish on them. What is the market like? What have they been used for? I mean, we tend to think of bonds for municipal projects, infrastructure projects, and so on. Islamic bonds used for the same sort of thing?
A lot of some similarities. The term sukuk is a plural, and the individual is sock, and the sock is a certificate of ownership. So you can think of it that way. Well, a bond is you're lending your money on that full faith and credit that they're going to pay you back at some point in time, and they're also going to give you that coupon. But in the sukuk world, the money deployed in a sukuk is meant for that economic, tangible use. So our money in a sukuk goes into building toll road, for instance. There's a project, Sukuk was used in Nigeria last year to build a toll road. So my money is going into building that piece of infrastructure, and then the yield paid to me is from the actual people driving on that road and paying to use it. And this is a road through the oil-producing region that the oil companies would pay to use. So things like that. You're linked to the economic underlying asset versus just a repayment. The Sukuk industry is about $400 billion in total outstanding products at the moment. In the next 2 years, we have about $75 billion in Sukuk that are going to mature. And the majority of people that are making these investments are fixed income managers, at investment houses, at bank treasuries, at pension funds. And one thing those people really hate is that cash back on the balance sheet. So the hope and the expectation is that over the next 2 to 3 years, at a minimum, there's going to be $100 billion in issuances for that money to be reinvested in, plus the new money coming in the system. And to go back to the start of your question, what have they been used for? The first Sukuk Roadshow event I went to was in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia, and it was a very nice lunch, and it was put on by Al Marai, which is Saudi Arabia's version of Dairy Gold, the big milk producer. And they issued a Sukuk to buy land in Argentina to grow alfalfa, and that alfalfa was then shipped back to Saudi Arabia for the cows. They have these massive warehouses a couple hours north of the city where the cows live and produce the milk and all that. So they needed a way to really grow a food source for the cows. But that was just, you know, it's just one kind of anecdotal use. But Sukuk had been used. GE Capital issued a $500 million Sukuk about 10 years ago to build airline engines. Sukuk have also been used, massive real estate projects, infrastructure projects, building ships. They've been issued by Goldman Sachs, issued one for a real estate program. Airlines have issued them to buy planes from Boeing or to lease planes from Boeing or Airbus. So it's a global industry, and we've even seen a fair number of Sukuk issued by governments as well. The UK government has done two. The Hong Kong government did one. But to really drive it home, 50% of the issuances come out of Malaysia because it's a combination of corporate, sovereign, quasi-sovereign, and financial institutions issuing them. The same way here in America, we would issue treasuries.
So how much money, if you were to total it up, is controlled by Islamic banks, investment houses? We were talking about sovereign wealth funds a little bit earlier and how large some of those are. If you were to tote that up, how much money is controlled by those entities?
There's been a lot of debate around this number. The number that's been flowing around the last year or two is between $2 trillion and $2.5 trillion. And I would say the majority of that, at least $1.7 trillion, is controlled by banks. These are retail deposits, these are corporate deposits, so on and so forth. And this is why programs like Sukuk are so big, because if money goes into a savings account, well, they can't just give you money on money. You can't make money for money. So they actually have to invest that money. So it goes into the Sukuk world, which is low risk and yield current. But the other side of Islamic finance is that there's a lot of money behind the scenes that isn't public. So generally an investment industry is judged by the size of the mutual fund business, right? But if you look at Islamic mutual funds around the globe, the total assets under management are around 70, 80 billion. But that is almost like the introductory point, where maybe there's a mutual fund in Malaysia that has 10 million under management, and you think, how does this massive financial institution, why would they keep a mutual fund running with only 10 million? You're never going to be able to pay the bills on it. But the reality is that's almost like the gateway, where behind the scenes you might have a private account with 250 million in it with the same exact allocation as the mutual fund. So it's almost really hard to judge how big the industry is. And then when you think about private accounts include money from family offices. There are family offices in Saudi Arabia that have $5, $10, $15 billion in assets. And then you also have, which is very unique to the Islamic finance industry, called WAQF or Al-Qaf, which are Islamic endowments. And this is, the amount of capital in these is tremendous. Some people think it could be high as $1 trillion. So that would be an entire, the economics and the use of capital with Islamic endowments could be an entire podcast.
So what asset classes do Islamic investors tend to favor? Is that clear cut? Is there an asset class or two that they tend to favor? And why, if you know the answer, why do they favor a particular asset class or two?
Real estate is probably one of the largest. Someone in Saudi once said to me, land was given to us by God, so we have to maintain it, we have to grow it, we have to make it valuable. And then also when you think about when this capital started to flow out of Asia and Arabia, the first places were kind of the Western capitals of the world for real estate. So there are family offices in Saudi that have owned prime real estate in London, New York, Paris since the 1970s. It's that tangible thing that they can see, they can feel. They know it's not going to change too much over the years, and it really is a mainstay of the industry. But there's a lot of Islamic pension fund programs that are popping up that are really growing in size, some in Malaysia, that have a real desire for real estate, but also private equity, and then even some venture capital is coming into it. But the other side of it is that there are so many companies around the world that can be classified as Sharia compliant based upon, their debt-to-asset ratios or how they make their money. So technically, if you had a brokerage account at an Islamic bank and used that money, your brokerage account, to go invest in shares of Apple, well, technically that's an Islamic investment. So that's another way to think of it as a global industry, as where capital flows.
So what attracted you to Islamic finance? You're the first person I've ever met who is an expert in this field. What drew you to it?
When I came out of college, I mainly studied management and marketing. I didn't have a huge finance background. But my second or third year out of college, the financial crisis hit in 2008, and I had spent some time in the Middle East, in Dubai, right after I finished college. And at that point in time, there was a lot of buzz around Islamic finance, and it was financing condo real estate developments and other infrastructure projects. And I was very curious about it. And so I read a bit, and then I came home to the U.S. and, got the typical 9-to-5 job in the suburbs. And the financial crisis hits, and at the same time, I'm reading a book by one of the economists I mentioned at the beginning of our talk. And I read his book, which came out in 1985, and everything in this book was kind of a highlight of every financial crisis that had happened since 1900, and how the same things were going on over and over again. And also, not coming from a traditional finance background in college, Islamic finance really spoke to me because it was very principle-based. There are clear rules you have to follow. And there's a very strong ethical component to it as well, the kinds of things you can invest in. So effectively, no sin stocks.
No alcohol, no tobacco, no drugs and such.
Weapons, pornography, all that alcohol. Yeah.
Got it.
Which really has a lot in common with ethical, social, ESG, SRI, these other terms that have kind of really popped up in the last few years. But I think the reason that I liked it so much is because I could understand it, because we can't play in the world of derivatives or complex financial engineering. Everything has to be clear, transparent, rules-based finance. And so I found that to be very, very appealing. And then I just kept reading, and then I enrolled in a distance learning program, a graduate program, and then after that I moved on to a full-blown master's program in the UK on it. And then after I graduated, I found my way to Saudi Arabia at a relatively young age. When most expats go to the kingdom, they tend to be much further along in their careers. And I went kind of fresh right out of school, and I worked at a very conservative Islamic bank in the capital, and kind of, learned by some real players in the industry.
What are, you know, as you look down the road, I mean, you said you're less than 40 years old, so you got a long career ahead of you. What do you hope to accomplish during that time? Do you have some particular goals in mind? Is there any kind of changes you'd like to see affected in maybe the broader use of finance?
There's some really interesting work going on at a group called the RFI Foundation. It's a Responsible Finance Initiative. And what it's looking to do, which I really gel with, is they're trying to come up with a set of rules that will encompass Islamic finance, socially responsible investing, ethical investing, green investing into one, because they're all rules-based. But as a whole, they don't have clear cut-and-dry rules like Islamic finance does. So I would really like to see the RFI Foundation grow, and I know the guy behind it, and what their goal, their mission is to sign up financial institutions, regulatory bodies all over the world to effectively kind of jump on the bandwagon and say, we're going to operate our financial system, either our bank or our country's regulatory system, based upon these clear-cut rules, which I think is very intriguing when, you know, there's so much talk now about the environment and sustainable living and sustainable economies, which I find is really fascinating. But on a personal level, I would like to see in the Islamic finance space more global capital flows. One reason why I like the Sukuk industry so much is the opportunity in it. Even though, as I said, it's a $400 billion industry, 90% of the issuances come out of Asia and Arabia. So, but if you're a fund manager, a fixed income fund manager, for instance, you want a range of assets to produce that stable yield for your pensioners or your insurance subscribers. And so when these Sukuk products and other institutional-grade Islamic finance products come out in the West, in the U.S., in Europe, in Asia, in Africa, there tends to be an oversubscription because it presents that rare opportunity for these managers to broaden their geographic exposure. So that was always one thing that really appealed to me, how to make a more globally tradable, globally linked system in the Islamic finance world. And so that was one of the reasons I moved from Saudi Arabia back to the U.S. to try to pursue these initiatives. I just like to see more growth, more awareness, more commonality. In the UK, there's been some great work at Al Rayan Bank, for instance, an Islamic bank in Birmingham. But large numbers of their clients that have used them for banking services, for home mortgages, are non-Muslims because it has more of a ethical community mechanism to it, a more fair rules-based principles and systems.
Interesting. So is the organization you mentioned that's putting together these principles that incorporate Sharia-compliant finance and such, is it getting any traction? Do you see some movement as far as, the broader finance industry is concerned, or you are seeing something going on there that there's some traction?
Yeah, they have a growing list of signatories. I'll say the majority of them are in Muslim majority countries, but the geographic dispersion of where these people are, Africa, Australia, Malaysia, Indonesia, and in fact, one of the, I can't remember if it's the chairman or someone at the top of the board is the governor of the Malaysia Central Bank. So there's some traction, and so our company, Pentaveret, and then also Hamaya, we're going to be joining with them as well as a signatory to effectively say we are going to start to manage our business and also our investments by a set of common rules.
Our guest has been Tom Polson. He's Director of Global Investments for Pentaveret. And as you have just heard, a recognized expert in Islamic finance. Tom, I really appreciate you taking the time. Like I said, it's a mysterious subject, but much less so since you walked us through it. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Mike. I look forward to being on again someday.